Hello and welcome to today's edition of Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and my very special guest, Ian Mack. Hello, Ian.
Hello. This is weird.
Isn't it? Yeah, we've turned the tables on you. Yeah. So I know how it feels for me because I do this every Friday. How does it feel for you being that side of the desk?
It feels really strange because when I was waiting for the queue then and I was just about to go and I thought, hang on, it's not your show.
You remember that. No, Ian is our head honcho, radio guru, and today, quite literally, he will be a legend in his own lunchtime.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
A bit first.
So this is the show where we talk about, you know, the joy of life and those moments where life pulls a rug from under you, and you know, we do that marvellous thing of wanting the whole ground to just swallow us up. So that's going to be my first question to you, Ian. Since you've been here at Vectus, what has been your biggest pratfall? One of those moments when you thought, oh no, please no.
To be honest, there's one that springs to mind, but it wasn't in my Vectus time.
Oh, go on then.
We were at the Garlic Festival, and it would have been about sort of 1998-ish, and it was my time at Isle of Wight Radio, and I was like hosting the what they called the Show on the Road. And it was I would go out on stage, and I would get the crowd going, get them up on stage, and you know, we would go through competitions, and they'd be doing daft things and so on and so forth, and we'd be giving away prizes, and some of the prizes were quite good, so people would be excited about them. And there was this lady at the front of the audience, and she was like really excited, and it was shaking with excitement. And I said, oh, are you really excited? And she said, no, I've got Parkinson's. That's the biggest, you know. And at that moment, yeah, I wanted the ground to swallow me up, and I just said, I got a feeling you're going to win.
Oh, yes.
And she did.
Oh, well, you weren't to know. You weren't to know.
That's the thing. You'd never know what's going to happen in radio. You just don't know how people are going to react. And that's kind of a buzz, kind of an excitement as well. But you've always got to be wary of it. And since then, I've been on my toes. And you kind of, instead of, you know, being a little bit more upfront, you do step back sometimes. So you can see these things coming.
Oh, if only, so yes, to be able to do that. So today, what I'd like to do is discover, you know, Ian Mack, the man behind the mic. What do you think?
Crikey, yeah.
Yeah.
Warts and all.
Yeah, because I just wonder if when we're behind this and we're on radio and people can't see, if we're, you know, we're projecting something different, and I think people would like to know who you really are, because you're always interviewing people, promoting the show, promoting the station, and I think they'd like to know more about Ian.
Okay, well, pretty much I'm just like anybody else, and you know, one of the reasons why we started Vectus Radio was because I had such a lovely time, you know, working in pubs and clubs and on a radio as well. And I just wanted to prove that other people could do it as well. Just like many people all those years ago, we used to listen to the charts on a Sunday.
Yes, yeah.
And I remember it was a guy called Tom Brown. And I remember being about 7 or 8 years old and just being allowed to sort of sit in my brother's doorway, because I was very noisy. And when the music came on, I would do the singing thing. And they were trying to record the charts. And
that was a thing, wasn't it? Recording the charts. Yeah.
On our little tape machines.
That's
and
right.
it was this particular time, it was long before the 5-din pin lead, which you could take direct from the radio to the cassette.
That's very technical for me, you know that, Ian. You're just blinding me with science now.
Wow.
It doesn't take much, I know.
But you used to have a microphone, and you'd put the microphone by the speaker. And in the next few years, what happened was that you had a 5-din pin lead that linked the two up so you could talk. But it was in the days where we didn't have a 5-din pin lead, so I was allowed to just sit in the doorway, and very often I'd be kicked out when Tom Brown was doing the chart rundown or playing the songs, because I would start singing, I would get asked to leave. And that was the first time I sort of was inquisitive about radio.
Right.
I grew up thinking that, you know, radio, people on the radio were very tiny, and they were inside the radio.
Oh, like the people inside the telly, yeah.
And 5 years ago, I found out that wasn't true.
So you're not that small then?
No.
You're just an optical illusion. But you are the disappearing man, aren't you? Because you've lost a lot of weight, even in the short time I've known you.
Well, strange, because in September last year I went to see the doctor, and the doctor said to me, I went for the 50-year checkup, which I was, people wound me up about. They said they did all sorts of things to you, and they didn't. They just did, you know, took blood pressure and stuff.
You sound slightly disappointed, Ian.
Well, I was relieved.
I bet you were.
And maybe that was what made my blood pressure go up. But, I was told that I was overweight. My blood pressure was sky high. They were worried about my cholesterol levels as well. And anyway, I went for some tests, went back, and the doctor sort of said to me, sat me down and said, "So how important is living to you?"
Wow, and the big question.
I thought, yeah, it is quite important, yeah. So he said, "Well, you're a heart attack waiting to happen. You've got to do something about it." And I said, "What?" And he said, "Well, you've got to lose some weight." So I went home, and for the whole weekend, I ate more, I drank more, and thought, you know, doctors. And then by the time the Monday came around, I thought, do you know what, you better give this a go if you want to be here in a couple of years' time, yeah. Which, you know, you want to see the job through. So I decided that we were going to, you know, do more walking. I told my wife to go and buy smaller plates. She didn't get that at first, but now she does, because I come from an age group where if you've got a plate full of food, you're going to eat it. And if you've got a big plate, it's going to be a lot of food.
Yeah, so. I think Elton John did that with Elizabeth Hurley. She had her baby. She went and lived with him so that nobody saw her. And she lost all her baby weight by having a tiny plate and a tiny sort of dolly's knife and fork.
It's logical. Mm. And we went out and bought some plates, and they're horrible plates. But we went in a pound shop, and they got roses on. But it's fine. It's worked. And
you do that thousand? Is it 1,000 paces a day? You do 1,000 steps.
10,000. Sitting behind a microphone most of the day, you don't realise just how little you move, and you don't realise how much damage you're doing to yourself. So we went out and bought these things that you put on your wrist, and they actually tell you to stand up every now and again. I thought, crunk, I've got a wife to tell me what to do. Now I've got something around my wrist, but she's not here. So it's just when it's like she's there in the room with you. So from that, and it's just a number of things. I started drinking less, because you know, we all have a drink now and again. But I decided that I was going to, through the week, going to eat sensibly, drink sensibly, none at all, and wait for the weekend. And then don't go too mad at the weekend, but you know, you can still eat relatively well over the weekend. But then just sort of fast a little bit during the week.
Yeah, and are you? Do you feel better?
I feel much better. Yeah. I feel. I've just been given a bike, and I got on this bike, and I thought, I haven't been on a bike for about 5 years, and I rode for a couple of miles yesterday and a couple of miles the day before, and I thought, crikey, how easy is this? I couldn't have done this a year ago.
No, brilliant.
So I'm a lot fitter, a lot leaner. I've lost 2.5 stone, and I've got about a half a stone to do. But then I'm going to go out and buy myself a new wardrobe.
Yeah, to put all your new very small clothes in.
Yeah, my son's quite amazed actually, because I now have the same waist as him. He's a 30-inch waist, and so am I. So,
how much have you lost again?
2.5 stone.
That's fantastic. I was almost, over how long?
Since September last year.
Wow.
So I want to get down to 12 stone by September, and that would have been a whole year.
Yeah.
And the good thing about that is you're sort of coaching yourself to eat sensibly and drink sensibly and take up the exercise as well. So it's not a get fit quick scheme. It's a habit. You get into that good habit,
yes.
And all of a sudden,
yeah.
You know, it's easy.
Yeah, I was in the theatre the other day, and there was a girl next to me. We didn't realise that when the lights came up, we were sitting amongst a school party. But she ate throughout the entire first act a family-sized bag of crisps. You know, what as kids we'd have had for four of us, because those little bags just don't cut it anymore with people, do they? They've always got to have this sort of family size. So she munched her way through the first act, and I thought, okay, now there's the interval. Presumably you might have an ice cream, and that'll be that, you're done. No, the whole second act, she found some sort of gummy bears or something and sucked her way through the second act. But again, it was this massive sort of family size pack, and you looked at the size of it and you thought, my God, you know. Mm. We've just got used to eating more, haven't we? These
we
kind of massive portions.
We have. And yeah. I didn't realise how easy it was to cut down and how little you actually do need.
Mm.
You know, I came from a family that they dished up, and you had to finish what was on your plate. And if you could see the plate when your dinner was dished up, you would say, oh, that's a really small dinner, isn't it?
Yeah.
So, you know, by getting the smaller plates, it reduced the amount. But it just made you realise your tummy then shrieks, and then now if somebody wants to put a really large dinner in front of me, I'd really struggle with it. And you don't really need it. Just think it's a mindset. It's in there. You think that that's what you need.
Yeah, and I think a lot of, because it's become so commonplace, isn't it, that people do eat a lot around you. So when you're saying no, that's quite, it's quite a different, it's odd, isn't it?
Well, we went out to a Chinese restaurant not so long ago, and we were looking around. They brought out the food. We had a starter and a main, and that's it. We were full. And then we watched this family on the other table, and they were like the fat family from hell.
Oh, no, you can't say that.
They were just piling it in. And you know, 12 months ago, I'd have been thinking, come on, let's have a competition. Let's see how far we can go with this. But then I was watching them thinking, crikey, the damage you're doing to yourselves. And you don't need all that food, surely.
No. Storing yourself up. So going back to what you were saying earlier about, you said sort of, you told me, you said pubs and clubs. So was that where you started DJing then?
Yeah.
And when was that?
Well, it was probably about 1978-79. I was only about 14 or 15, inspired by two people. One was Martin Bully Bull, who used to work here at Vectis Radio and Isle of Wight Radio as well, and we've been good buddies for years. And another good friend of mine, Lewis Wilkinson. And the first place we ever did a gig is now the Morrison's Coffee Shop.
Oh, right.
It used to be a little church hall in there. And that's where we first sort of started, about 78, 79. And it just progressed from there. Left school and started buying more and more records, built up a bit of a roadshow, and went out and did pubs and clubs. And I ended up in, working in a club in Egypt in 92. I went from club to club on the island.
What was that like, working in Egypt in clubs?
It was it was the strangest thing ever.
I bet.
Because I'd worked at, you know, Barney's Roadhouse. I was at Colonel Bogey's for a time. I even worked at the Ride Queen. I was actually the last guy in at the Ride Queen, 1989, and that now is just a rusty old boat along at Medina there. And I say 3 years later, I ended up in this nightclub in Egypt.
Yeah.
And I was this gobby, leery guy that used to get the crowd going, and that was my
your thing, yeah.
It was just fun.
What was your name? Did you have a special handle name?
Well, my first roadshow was called Pac-a-Mac Roadshow.
Right.
I knew you'd laugh. And it came out of a line, actually, of a Squeeze song, and on an album called East Side Story. And it was just from a Pac-a-Mac to a compact case. And I just thought, Pac-a-Mac, compact, disco. Yeah,
Ian Mac. Yeah. It's all going on. Brilliant.
So there I was, over there in Egypt, being used to loud and leeriness. I turn up at the airport, and I'm there trying to get a visa. You have to get your passport stamped. And back then, I had long hair and an earring. And I'm there, and I'm stood behind this barrier, and all of a sudden I get all these Egyptian people looking at me, and they're all giving me a sign.
And what was that sign, Ian, for those listeners who didn't see what you just did?
Well, it looked like, do you know that old-fashioned 1970s way of men talking about ladies in a way that they shouldn't? It was like, of course, she was a bit of all right. That's what they were kind of doing to me.
Really?
And I thought, hang on a minute, what's going on? The guide that was with me, she said, oh, they think you're fair game. I said, what do you mean by that? And she said, well, because you've got long hair and an earring.
Oh.
Do you know what? I went down the barber the next time. Short back and sides, the earring came out as well.
And that's your look now, isn't it? To this very day.
Scarf,
just to be on Zoe's side.
Scarfy for life.
So as a crowd, I mean, was it all much the same then, or how did they react? Different music, or what was it like, the atmosphere in there?
It was not what I was used to at all. It was a massive, massive culture shock. And our Saturday night, or what used to be a Saturday night, things have changed, but our Saturday night, they used to have on a Thursday, so their busy night was a Thursday. And they would, you'd be in the club. I mean, if you worked at Barney's, you were there 9 till 1. If you were there, you worked from something like 9 through until 6 in the morning. It was a long, long shift.
Yeah.
One of the reasons it put me off of working in nightclubs and definitely doing international stuff. But they would come and they would dance, and you had to make a point of playing at least 2 Egyptian songs an hour. And they love that. They pack the dance floor.
What's an Egyptian? I mean, are they good songs, or are they?
I got into it in the end. I thought it was quite good, actually. I mean, but it was just a little bit different to ours.
What about the general behaviour? Was it quite raucous or well-behaved?
Very well behaved. they closed the club. Let me just, if you would close a club in England or on the island if there was a bit of a riot, I'm guessing. But over there, they closed the club one night because a brother tried to kiss his sister-in-law. So so they closed the club. The manager of the club just came up and said, close, shut the music down. Back in Britain, if there was like any kind of trouble, we would turn the music up because it kind of confused people. But over there, they just said this guy was trying to kiss that person there on the table. There was no fight. There was a bit of a standoff, but he just came over and said, shut the club.
Enough.
So he went home. Yeah. And that's how they do things. It's totally different to the way we do things.
And what's their drinking?
Oh, drinking? Yeah. Crikey, yeah.
And it was all legal, or was it?
I had many a time somebody would send over like a 15-year-old malt bottle of scotch and I thought you'd take a drink out of it and pass it back. No, they bought you that bottle and it was you kept it for the evening.
Not well, lovely.
I took it home and had some fun with it.
Yeah. And then you came back to the island.
I came back in, I was out there for about 6 months, and then I came back and I just had to get a job. And the partner I was with at the time said, what do you want to do? Because I was offered another tour of Morocco. And I thought, well, I've just done Egypt. I'm pretty sure that's going to be quite similar. I'm not sure whether I want to do that or not. So she said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, I'd love to have a crack at radio. I've always wanted to do radio. So I sent some tapes up to Andy Shire at Isle of Wight Radio, and he took me under his wing, and then I bombarded him with more tapes, and he just said, look, stop with the tapes. You go into what was known as Studio B, learn the desk, and we'll put you on air. And I said to myself, if I don't get a job up there within a year, I would then go and get myself a proper job, as my mum would say.
And what would a proper job have been?
9 to 5.
Which one? What would you have done?
To be honest, I mean, I've had so many. I've worked in it. I was manager of a shop. I've been a boat builder.
What was the worst one?
The worst one was probably, I was working at Plessy's. I was a containerisation technician, which is...
Go on.
A packer.
Yep. That we're going back to the pack mac, aren't we?
We are, yeah. And every morning I used to get on my bed, when the alarm would go off at 7:10, he'd sit there and think, God, there's something better than this. There really is something better than this. And that's how, for years, that's how I was thinking. And I thought, give it a go. If it don't work out in 12 months, you'll just have to go back to some kind of, normal job, 9 to 5, whatever. And I was lucky enough, within 9 months, I got that job. And I was there for about 16 years, didn't look back. It was a fabulous time. Worked with some talented people, learnt my trade.
Yeah, and you really, I mean, you are a guru, aren't you? I mean, I was watching you with the young guys, so it's almost come full circle, hasn't it? Because you're now passing that knowledge on to the next generation with the 4Ps project.
Well, it's a nice thing to say, thank you, but that's exactly it. And all I want to do is just give people the opportunity that I kind of struggled to have, because back in the day there wasn't, you know, when I really wanted to be on radio, 1986, there wasn't any stations on the island then. Now there are a number, and it's a little bit easier to get into. So it's just, and it's my way of putting something back. Of course it is, and it's a lovely feeling when you can get youngsters come in and they can, you know, come through the ranks, and all of a sudden they go off and have a career in radio or media. And I say it's just putting something back, but it's proving that we can all do it.
Yeah.
And it's given people the opportunity to have a go at something that I really, really enjoy.
Because I think what you're really good at is giving people the confidence to have a go and to try it and to see how far they can go. And I think that's a really lovely skill that you've got to give people that feeling that, yeah, I can do it, I'll give it a go. And that's what you instill. I can see that when they come in. And it was great just watching you before we came on air, just talking that guy through the sound levels on a promo, you know, and you just do it so instinctively. And he looked at you and then he did it and he was like, yeah, you're right. And you think, yep, no surprise there, that because he's kind of learning from the master. So how long has this program been going, the 4Ps?
We kind of wanted to set it up right in, you know, the early days of Vectis, but we didn't have a premises to do it. So the idea was there from the start, but we've been doing it now for about 3 years. We did it in a... because we arrived at the Riverside Centre about 3 years ago, and we were out in the shed. This studio was the size of the radio station.
Yeah.
and we had three students in as well as, you know, live presenters. And we thought, well, if we can pull this off here, we can pull it off anywhere.
Exactly.
And then we were offered this place here. And 19 years ago, this place was Platform One. This was a music studio. So it was just nice to come in here.
Yeah, and just remind for those people who may not know, what does the 4Ps stand for?
I stumble on this every time. I wrote this program and I presenting, yep. Producing, podcasting, and promoting.
Brilliant.
So all in that order, really.
Yeah.
You do some presenting, then you produce what you've presented and podcast it, and then you promote it.
So how long do they get when they come on board? How long do they come for?
Well, these lads have been here for 5 days and they've had 5 sessions because it's like a work experience for them.
It's fairly full on, isn't it?
It is. When they come. It is if you're trying to do it in 5 days, it is, because you're trying to cram in an awful lot. But the rest of the time, it's over a 10-week period. They're here for 4 or 5 hours and it's over a 10-week period. So there's lots of stuff they can do in between the week. But this is like, you know, this is full on. 5 days is... Yeah. Those guys actually work quite hard.
And have you had any where you've sort of followed them through, or they've kept in touch with you and let you know how they're getting on?
There's been a number of people that have come back and actually they're doing shows. I mean, one of the first people on the course was Robert Clark, otherwise known as Chip.
Ah, yes.
And
yes, yes.
He was a cracking lad. He really is. He was a former St. Catherine's pupil. He so wants to do radio, and he's turned up. And I don't like to use this expression because I don't like to put people in boxes, and I don't like it when people restrict people. But he has, for want of another phrase, because I don't like this phrase, is he had learning difficulties, but you wouldn't think it.
No, he's brilliant, isn't he?
He is. I mean, I said to him recently, I said, do you know what? When you first turned up, your speech was slow, and you know, so now his speech is superb. You wouldn't think he had any problems at all. I don't think he has any problems. And one day when we go FM, Chip is going to sit where you're sat, not doing your show, but he's going to be sat where you're, and he's going to be doing a live show. And he's going to be doing a live daytime show. That's my dream. That's above all, everything else at FM, I'm really looking forward. There's so many people I want to, you know, big up and give opportunities to and so on. But that, to me, is the icing on the cake.
Yeah, and that will be a reality, won't it?
It is, yeah.
In 2017, when we go FM, Chip will have that live show.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's down to you, because he is definitely somebody that I can, like you say, he has grown in stature for himself and confidence, hasn't he? He's just so full, because he loves what he does here, doesn't he? And I think that comes through, and it's great that you've given him, you know, that push and that confidence.
You
to do what he loves.
Can't put a price on that.
No.
Can't put money on that. That to me is that brings a lump to my throat. Mm. It really does.
No, it's wonderful. So I know how excited you are, and we all are, about the FM thing. So tell us a little bit more about that, Ian.
Well, something that we had an idea last October. We had to beat a deadline to get in and go for a community license. And you know, the driving force behind this is obviously there's a few other people involved, Kelvin Curry and David Parkinson and a couple of others as well. We filled in that form, which took forever and a day because it was about 57 pages.
Sounds hideous.
And it was, and on the day, I've got to tell you this, on the day we had a deadline, because they stick to deadlines, and they are so, you have to stick to things with Ofcom. So we had a 5 p.m. deadline. I've got the thing in my lap. We filled it in, and it's up to me now to give the ball to Ofcom, and that's it. It's in, it's done. So we're doing this online.
I was going to say, it's not a physical form, it's online, yeah?
It's online. So there I am, I'm, and all of a sudden the internet goes down. So I've turned the air blue. I've got really stressed and stroppy.
Yes.
And for some reason, then when I managed to get things going, my Gmail account is not accessible, and also my bank, I can't transfer the funds, £600, for the application. And it's 20 to 5. And anyway, I by about 7 minutes to, it'd come back on, and we just managed to hit the deadline.
Wow.
And I thought, I wonder if that was an omen. Should we have saved ourselves £600? Can I go on holiday? Well, I'm glad that's not the, you know, that wasn't the case. But now we've been given a community license. It is a 2.5 I think it's 2.5-3 miles. It's 5 kilometres around Newport. So, you know, we will go FM next year. We are wanting to embrace Newport like we are anyway, and hopefully Newport will embrace us.
Yeah, and I think on a good day, it will go further. It's just they guarantee it for 5 kilometres. That's right, isn't it? So probably you can hear it.
So we're in the process now of finding transmitter sites and so on and so forth. And I've got to be honest, Kelvin Curry's in his element.
I bet.
He loves all this. Wires, technology and stuff.
I was going to say, if you want any help, just come to me in. You know that. Okay. I'm always here for you for the techie stuff.
Okay.
Oh, I've just got to share this because when I first started doing this unaided without Ian sort of beside me, made some couple of technical boo-boos and phoned Ian up because I thought I can't do this again next week. So I phoned him up and asked him what to do. And Ian said, no, one back. What did you just say? And I said, well, Ian, I managed to play the news out sort of twice in the hour. And Ian said these wonderful words. He went, with respect, Joan. And I thought that now there will be no respect coming my way from Ian because I have completely messed this up. Anyway, I did it once and I pray to God I never do that again. But fear is a great driver. No, but, you know, you've kind of taught me all I know on here, Ian, and, you know, it's just the best fun. It's the best fun on a Friday. I can come in here, you know, feeling quite low. I've got a miserable, rainy, old, horrible summer's day and do this for an hour and talk to someone. And it's just, yeah, it's brilliant, brilliant. So thank you very, very much indeed.
You're welcome. And at the end of the day, I have this old saying. I said there's an old saying in radio, but I've never heard anybody else say it. Nobody dies.
No, that's right.
And it is, we all, like in life, we make mistakes. And the mistakes that we're going to make or we make on air, they're not life-threatening.
No, they're nothing in comparison, are they?
And that's exactly it. And we, it makes us human.
Exactly, exactly. Okay, I will remind you of that, I'm sure.
You're gonna have the
the
news
coming
now.
Months, yeah, we'll have the news. Okay, and so after the break, we'll be back with Ian, and I'm going to be probing a little bit further into the man behind the mic. Okay, speak soon.
The Lunchtime Social Debate, brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
This is Vectis Radio.
For the people, by the people.
The White Military and Heritage Museum in Northwood. The museum will excite your senses and immerse you in a world of human success over adversity. Call 01983 300037 for more details or to book your ride.
Andy Gustar has details of the £10 meal deal at Hamilton's Fine Foods.
Oh, that's been running for quite some time, and we're still doing it for £10, and I think, why change something that's really working well? You get a fresh chicken in there, 400 grams of steak mince, you get a pound of sausages, and you get a quarter of ham. All of that for £10. There's a lot of meals there for a family of two or three. The important thing to add to that is it's quality food as well. You must, I think, for the sake of your own health, look to a quality product which is going to be that good for you.
Hamilton's are in Newport, they're in Pyle Street. Where else are you?
We're in Cowes High Street, Wootton Bridge. We also have a shop now on Dodder Industrial Estate.
Hamilton's Fine Foods, the best local butcher in town.
Vectis Radio is regularly streamed over 4,000 unique times each month, which means our Listen Live button is pressed around 25,000 times. With Vectis Radio, you don't need an advertising budget in the thousands for an effective advertising campaign. We offer affordable advertising to local businesses, with packages starting from as little as £50 a month. If we can help you market your business, don't hesitate to get in touch with our marketing department. Just email vectisradiomarketing@gmail.com or call 07741 664 393. That's 07741 664 393.
Stay social and get in touch. Give us a call on 01983 240 666. or add us on Skype. It's Vectis.radio. The World Wide Web never felt so local. So local.
The Lunchtime Social Debate brought to you by Real Employment Law Advice, your legal lighthouse guiding you through a sea of employment law. A solicitor's firm with a difference. Go to realemploymentlawadvice.co.uk for more information.
Hello and welcome back to Wit, Wisdom and Pratfalls with me, Joan Ellis, and our very own Ian Mack, head honcho, radio guru, legend in his own lunchtime. So, welcome back, Ian. And so we've spoken about, you know, you, the radio man, and, you know, the professional Ian. I'd really like to know more about you, because we hear you, but, you know, it's you as a person I'm really interested in. And I know you've, I mean, because to me you always sound like a Londoner, but I know you're an Islander, aren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really strange to say that, because I from quite an early age, I think we've all had a bit of ooh-ah, because we're down here on the island. But, you know, from a very early age, yeah, my mum used to say the same thing, sound like an Islander, a Londoner. But it's really spooky. The reason why it's spooky is because when I was 20, I found out my dad wasn't my dad, and he was a Londoner.
Oh, right, okay.
So, yeah, that was and incidentally, his brother was Frank Haynes, was a politician. And apparently he had the biggest and loudest voice in Parliament at the time. So
it's just what you need. So how did you find out that the man you thought was your father wasn't?
My mum told me.
Oh, in a sort of big moment, or how did that come out?
It was 1985.
Yeah.
And I was in the process of organising getting married. And very young, getting married, and you know, my mother-in-law-to-be said, you need to sort out who's coming, who you're inviting. And I didn't put my dad on the list, because my mum and dad had split up 18 years prior to that. And
so how old were you then, Ian?
I was 20.
Oh, you were 20?
Yeah, I was 20. That's
so
very young.
The man you thought was your dad, you'd only know, he'd been your dad for 2 years then, as a...
No, basically my mum split up with him when I was about two.
Yeah.
But I used to go and spend some days at the weekend with him over a long period of time. And when I got to the age of 20, I was told, you know, in a conversation, because I said, I don't really want him at a wedding. I only see him once a week, and he don't really have that much interest in me, and I don't have that much interest in him. Why does he have to be there? And she said, he's got to be there because he's your father. And I said, yeah, but we don't get on. You know, now I've got a little bit older, I very rarely go and see him. I only go out there to get a Christmas present, and he was cynical even then. And he was...
Honest.
Yeah, honest. So anyway, she said, he's got to be there, and that's that. We're not going to discuss this anymore. And I said, look, sorry, I'm going to be really forced. It's my wedding day. I don't really want him there. It will spoil the atmosphere. You've not been together for 18 years. We don't spend that much. Anyway, he doesn't have to be there if you don't want him to be there. He's not your dad anyway. And then it was this pause and this silence, and I'm thinking, what?
So it came out as a little bit of an argument then.
Yeah, it did.
She hadn't planned it.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel?
At the time, it was strange, because the lady that I was marrying was a lady that was adopted, and she previously, in the last 6 months, found out who her real parents were. And I remember, you know, meeting her about a couple of hours later and saying, you and I got something in common, and we both don't know who our dads are.
Yeah.
And, you know, it made me feel a bit strange, but there was a lot of relief as well, because,
because you didn't have that bond, and...
My brothers had the bond, and my sister had the bond with him, and I didn't. They were all totally different to me. They were all quite argumentative, and if you were to put us in a room and go back an hour later, I'd be at the other end by myself, and they'd be at the other end having a fight, having an argument. And that's still pretty much the same now. So, and you know, they hated anything to do with sport. I loved sport and football, and I was football crazy. And the bloke who I thought was my dad at the time, he was not into sport at all.
Yeah. So those, it was pretty apparent. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was relief.
Did you have a conversation with him afterwards?
Sadly, no. You know, I did feel sorry for him in the years to come because obviously that was in 1985. There wasn't the internet back then, so you know, my mum told me who my dad, my real dad, was, and you know, couldn't go and track him down. Then you had to write to the Salvation Army, and they said, "Well, we can't track him down because your mum and he wasn't married, so they wouldn't do it." So we, you know, I spent years trying to track him down, but didn't have any luck whatsoever. And all I had was a photograph that was about as big as my finger,
uh-huh.
and it was cut out of another picture of a group of
people.
I
know what you mean. Yeah. Did you look like him? Was there any physical resemblance?
It was really, really weird because the picture that he had, he sat in a chair and he's like that. With his hands on his knees. And that's how I sit.
Yeah.
And it was really weird. And I looked at his arms and I thought, crikey, he's got hairy arms. Because everyone used to comment on that, hairy arms. Crikey, you've got hairy arms. And he had this like wild sort of frizzy-ish hair. And he lost it and receded quite considerably. Thank goodness I had my mum's hair. But, you know. Yeah, that's all I had to go on. And all I had was a name. His name was James Oswald Haynes. He was married to a lady, I can't remember her name now, but I had three other brothers and sisters. There was Paula and Philip.
So you've got two sets of half-siblings, haven't you, on both sides? Yeah.
It kind of, you know, that moment of realisation of, hang on a minute, I've just lost all the... Because they all become half-brothers, my real brothers.
Of course, yeah.
They become, you know, affectionately known as half-brothers. And now I've gained another couple of half brothers and a half sister, and I've written half a book, and I make reference that I was useless at fractions, and I was trying to work it all out. So, and then where do you stand with your uncles, your aunties? Are they half uncles or half aunties and grandparents? Where you know?
You were the man in the middle of all this, weren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it was kind of confusing, but at the same time there was a relief. I must admit. It affected me later on in life because, you know, it took me 17 years to track him down.
So how did it affect you then?
It kind of affected me because you think about it more and you realise that where you are with all of this, with so all of those people and they were your uncle, they weren't your uncle, they were brothers, they're half-brothers, and you almost like think, your half your life or most of your life was a lie, you know, it's built on a lie, and that took a little bit, and it still does from time to time. It takes a little bit of getting used to.
But though, are you still in touch with your the first half siblings? Are you still in touch with them?
Well, some live on the island and some don't, and you know, there was a massive falling out in the family, which was not created by that. But I'm guessing it just made the situation a little bit deeper and you know, harder for us to get on. Maybe I don't know. Maybe that's in my head.
So you come from a really big family, yet you are an only child, aren't you?
That's what I tell people.
Yeah, enfant unique. You say in our French lessons. Yeah. So you actually met your father?
Yeah,
your birth father, as it were.
I was on air one lunchtime, and there was a lady that phoned me up, and she used to run a hotel, which was because the guy who I thought was my dad used to run a pub called the Anglers at Brading, and she said, "Are you related to the guy?" And I said, "That's a long story, because no, I'm not. We only share the same name." So and she said, "Oh right. So do you know who your dad is?" And I said, "Well, I've got a name and I've got a photo that's, you know, about the size of my finger. That's about it." And she said, "I'll track him down for you." And I said, "Yeah, all right, okay." So I gave him some details, and she got back to me about 2 weeks later. She said, "I've drawn a blank. I can't do it. Is there anything else you can tell me?" And I said, "Yeah, I can tell you the regiment that he was in." Anyway, so she went, because he was in the army. She came back a couple of days later and she said, "I found him, his telephone number."
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, "What, you found him?" I said, "Do me a favour." So anyway, I had this telephone number and I had an address. And I thought, what do I do with it now? Because you don't know what's happened to him. Where is he?
Exactly.
He's obviously still alive. Has he got remarried? I mean, am I going to rock his boat and his world? You know, he might have a lovely life, and all of a sudden I pop out of the woodwork.
That was very thoughtful of you to think like that, under the circumstances.
So I didn't know what to do. in the end, my mum told me this story that because they were my father and my other father, biological and non-bio, they were in the army, and I was conceived in Aden and born in Aden as well, and they were both out there at the same time. And I know that when my biological father came back to this country, he continued having a relationship, albeit through letters and stuff like that, from afar. And my mum was a dressmaker, and you remember those packages that you used to get with the dressmaking thing? They would come in flat pack, and they'd be all like full of tissue paper.
Oh yeah, the dress patterns.
And he used to basically hollow that out and put a letter inside.
Oh, how lovely!
So I thought, how am I going to? I know what I do. I'll send him a card. And I'll just say, I'm just wondering whether you are the same James Oswald Haynes that used to send my mother dressmaking patterns in Aden. I thought, well, nobody could make too much of that. And I got a message back within days saying, yes, I am. Thank you for the details. I will now contact your mother. And they spoke on the telephone, and he made arrangements to come down to meet up with my mum. He was living in Darlington. My mum was living in Whippingham at the time on the island. He came down and they met up, and he didn't go back for 2 weeks. So,
right.
You know.
So he had no idea up until that he'd received your card that you existed. Is that right?
He knew I existed, but he didn't know, you know, he just thought that we didn't want to contact him.
He
felt exactly the same way. But, yeah, they met up, and he was living with another lady that he'd been married to for a long time, but they were living in separate parts of the house. And he decided to come down, meet up with my mum. And so he went back 2 weeks later, and then he returned and didn't really go back.
There was a reignition of the romance.
There was. In actual fact, I mean, you know, it goes on, and he actually ended up marrying my mum about a year or so later. So, I was the best man.
Oh, I should hope you were. Yeah, definitely.
And my opening line in the speech was, guess what I'm not now? Seven letters beginning with
B. Okay. Well, so was that the kind of wonderful day I imagine it must have been?
It was.
Or did you feel slightly awkward and odd?
Yeah, slightly awkward and odd, but it was a nice day as well. But it's not the romantic story that people think it is. It was for my mum,
yeah,
because he was my mum's one true love. For me, it was slightly different, purely and simply because, you know, by then I was 37. It's kind of, do you know what I mean? I wasn't a child that could
embrace it. Yes,
and, yeah. You know, it was. I can't look. I'm 37 years old. I can't start calling you dad just like that. You know, and you know, he did say he wanted me to change my name, and I said, well, you know, I'm established of who I am, and it's just a name, and you give me another name, and I'm kind of, and you know, then my son was involved because he was happy with his name, and he said, well, what would happen to me? And I said, well, you'd be called that as well. And he said, well, I don't really want that, Dad.
No.
So we made we just sort of said, and it kind of upset him a little bit, but we just made the point, if you just can't come back in and wander in and just change things.
No, I suppose he had his vision, didn't he?
Sure.
And that's very different to the other people involved. Like you say, and then there's your son, Tom, and how old was Tom at that point?
At that point, he was probably about 7 or 8.
Right, so he already had his identity firmly fixed in who he was and where he'd come from. And
we both had football shirts with Macca Senior and Macca Junior on, and it was like, well, what would I have on the back of my shirt, Dad?
Oh, no.
And it was confusing, so
no,
we thought, I'm not going there.
No, but did you spot, like you said, there weren't the similarities between you and the guy you thought was your father? Did, once you met and got to know your dad, did you find that there were things that you thought, oh yeah, we are alike?
Yeah, we shared a similar same sense of humour. And his love of music, albeit classical. I mean, I'm not really into the classical music. I like all sorts of music. But he was a band leader, and you know, he just loved music. So do I. So there were, you know, there was a lot of similarities there. We looked, you know, people would say, yeah, they are, aren't they? Two peas in a pod. You can tell. The only thing that's different is that I haven't lost my hair like he did.
Me.
For now. But it was surreal. But I just wish that we'd had more time to get to know each other, because sadly he died 10 years ago, 2000. And so, strange enough.
So how long did you have together? In the later part there?
4 years.
Oh, that was too short.
It was too short, because, say it's roughly about now that he actually passed on. It was June 22nd, and here we are June 24th. Mm. I mean, it was kind of sad. I wish we'd had a little bit more time, because we'd have got to know each other better and so on. But it was, it was not to be. He died of a brain tumour, and we sort of, we went into hospital and saw him. Visited him every single day, and it was quite a strange. What's a really strange moment is, you go in to visit him. Yeah. You're walking up the corridor, yeah, and you see him in his bed, and then I do a double take with another door opposite, and in a bed there is the other dad, the non-bio dad.
No, that's just incredible.
And you think,
it?
Hang on a minute, they've not seen each other since their Aidan days. Halfway across the world, 1964, 1965, and there they are, sat in beds in the same hospital, in the same ward, 20 feet apart.
Talk about serendipity, yeah. It's freaky. Again, I can't imagine you literally standing in that corridor. It reminds us of a moment of a film, isn't it?
Yeah.
And if it happened in a film, you'd think, oh, that would never happen in real life. That's too much of a coincidence. And yet there you were, witnessing, both your dads, in effect, and being, again, that man in the middle, quite literally.
That's exactly it. But the fact that they're there, last time they were together... Mm. They were at the other side of the world. Here they are, same hotel, same hospital. And you think, crikey.
Were they aware of each other being there?
No, they weren't. Yeah. They weren't.
Probably just as well.
I don't know whether... I think they were, because they were old, and they were obviously in there, because sadly they died a couple of months apart.
I was going to say, so...
It may have been a great opportunity for them to make peace if there was any needed to...
And did you visit both of them?
No, I didn't, actually. I didn't need... Because I felt like, because of what happened, everyone kind of knew, and on the way in, I saw the other half of the family, and I thought, well, they must be going through some pain and some suffering. We said hello, but I thought, well, I don't want to now sort of say, you haven't seen me for 20 odd years, but and here I am. I didn't want to push him over the edge.
No, very considerate. God, it is such a filmic moment. And what about your mum? Was mum there?
Mum was there, and she, because she didn't believe me at first. She didn't. I said, you know what? I've just seen my other dad. I said, I've just seen him, and she said, where have you seen him? I said, he's here, he's here in this hospital in the same ward. And no, don't be stupid. So on the way out, we did another double take on the way out, and I said, he's there, and there's it. And she went, she had to go back and have another look.
Yeah, I bet.
Oh my God, she said, you're right.
You couldn't make it up, could you?
No, you couldn't make it up.
And this is all in the book you've started writing.
Yeah.
And have you got a title for it?
I had loads of working titles. I think Finding Father was, Finding Daddy was that one of the two I'm going to go with, I think. Unless I can come up with something, different.
Yeah, I quite like that. Yeah, finding father. Yeah. So are you going to do that as an audio book as well?
I think eventually. Yeah. Yeah. I've probably up to 7 chapters. I'm probably about halfway through, because they're quite long chapters.
Mm. How many words have you got?
Oh, crikey, you're asking a question. I really don't know. That's the one thing. I never actually doing this before. And to be honest, it's one of those things where I look at and think, yes, it would make a great film, but what I want to do is I want to leave these words for my son.
Yes.
It's more for him than anything else, because I think it's more about, I had a stepdad. He was a terrific guy. His name was Des, and my mum married him in 75, and he died in 85, and he was like a real father to me. And
that's dad number 3.
There was another one as well.
Okay.
Yeah, she kept the match ball. She had more than 3.
Good girl.
But he was a really, really lovely man, and he was a real, real father figure for 10 years when I was growing up as a child. And he was a terrific terrific chap. And, you know, I worship the ground he walked on, but I never had the chance to say to him, you know, how much I loved him as even though I wasn't his son. And I never had a chance because he died suddenly. And, you know, I don't want to get to that position where my son doesn't have that anything and he just has that, he has to make it up in his mind or what.
And all those questions that he can't ask.
They're all there.
And that conversation he can't have with the one person he needs to talk to.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know some people find that really difficult to have that conversation about when you're not here. And very often it gets swept under the carpet. But I say, come on, let's have that conversation now. Let's be honest. This is us. And you could, otherwise, you have to kind of make it up, don't you? You have to kind of, was he happy? Was he this? Was he that? You know, we're very open, very honest. And if anything, out of all of this, my son and I have a really open and honest relationship.
So I'm a great believer in that good coming out of bad. Not necessarily that that was bad, but, you know, out of stuff that we find difficult, good does come from it, doesn't it?
It
may
not
immediately, but sort of further down the line. So that's lovely. Well, you've all the equipment to turn it into an audio book here, and we've already done one together, haven't we? Mummy's Boy. But again, God love you. You know, you gave me that confidence and, you know, held my hand while we did that. And that was a real learning curve for both of us, wasn't it?
It certainly was.
But it's out there.
And it's a good book too.
Thank you. But it's out there now. So that's brilliant. We did it. So anyone, you know, the next ones are going to be so much easier, aren't they? So when you come to do yours, you know all the ducks and the dives for it, don't you?
Yeah, definitely. Absolutely. And thank you for the opportunity to be, you know, working on it, because, you know, I think there's lots of challenges out there, and I think, you know, we find new challenges. And I'm a great believer. I love it when people say you can't do something. You must have had that in the past, and you'll never be able to do that. And you think, right, I'm going to prove you wrong. That's all the incentive I need.
Yes. Thank you very much. Yeah, exactly.
I remember driving a car for the very first time and driving out to a nightclub, and somebody said, you'll never park in there. And I thought, red rag to a bull. I parked in this. You couldn't get out.
Love it.
I had to reverse back out, but you couldn't get out because they couldn't open the doors. But I love when people say you can't do something. I say, it's like when they say, you'll never be able to get Chip on air. Yes, we will.
Yes.
Oh, yes, we will.
Yes, indeed.
That's the way my mind works. Give me tell me I can't do something, I'll go and do it.
Yeah, it's why not, isn't it? It's not why. Why not? Yeah, let's find the way to do it rather than put up barriers to not do it. And I think that's really refreshing. I think so much in life that there are so many barriers, and there's so many no's, and there's so many gatekeepers trying to prevent things happening, that it's so refreshing when you meet someone like you that says, "Nah, come on board, let's give it a go, let's see how it works out." And doing the 4 P's and bringing all these youngsters on, I just think that's, you know, like I say, I think it's a lovely attitude to have, and must do, you know, brilliant for their confidence. Even if they don't go on to work in radio, it's something that they've conquered, and then that means they can go on and do the next thing, doesn't it?
Definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think you're going off on holiday, aren't you, Ian, now?
I'm having a couple of weeks off.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Somewhere nice and hot and gorgeous and exotic?
Not really, but I've got to be honest, as long as I'm with my wife, I don't care.
Lovely.
She is the inspiration to everything that I do. Her and my son, they're the inspiration.
Oh,
and they keep me going. So
that's a really lovely sentiment.
I just won't go skiing with her.
Probably very wise. Well, we haven't got time to go into why not. That's probably just as well. So, it's been an absolute joy talking to you. It's really been a pleasure getting to know you. And I look forward to talking to everybody again this time next week, when my guests will be Donna Jones, MBE, the poet, and Verrill Dunlop. Verrill has had a checkered career. She's been the wife of a publisher, and she's been a broadcaster and a PR girl in her day. And between the pair of them, I think we're going to have so much fun. So listen in next week for that. And in the meantime, go and enjoy the sunshine, because it's, I think today is summer, isn't it? After today, who knows? So just get out there, enjoy it, get in the sea, and have a brilliant weekend. Thank you so much, Ian.
Thank you.
And speak to everybody next week. Bye-bye.